The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their continued support. To continue from last week's edition of Smithsonian, the June 2019 edition, Inside America's Greatest Adventure by Charles Fishman. And because this article is so long, this will be the first time, at least since I've been reading, that it's taken 3 weeks to finish one article. But it's so exciting and interesting, I thought you'd enjoy it. I don't want you to miss a bit of it. So we finish up today with Inside America's Greatest Adventure. I'll replay the last sentence that we read last week to help you remember where we were. They had been tested and tweaked and custom tailored, but what happened on Earth really didn't matter, did it? That's what Ream was thinking. If Aldrin could trip and land hard on a moon rock, well, a tear in the suit wouldn't be a seamstress's problem. It would be a disaster. Continuing, the suit would deflate instantly, catastrophically, and the astronaut would die on TV in front of the world. The TV camera set up on a tripod would have a perfect view. Aldrin ran left, planted his left leg, then cut to the right, like an NFL running back dodging tacklers. He did kangaroo hops right past the American flag, but announced that this wasn't a good way of moving around. Your forward mobility is not quite as good as it is in the more conventional one foot after another, he said. Then he disappeared from view. By this time, Rhyme could barely contain his fretfulness. That silly so-and-so is out there running all over the place, he thought. Seconds ticked by. The moon base was quiet. Armstrong was working by the lunar module, his back to the camera. Suddenly, Aldrin came dashing in from the left, straight across the landing site, moon dirt flying from his boots. He was doing a moon run. As far as saying what a sustained pace might be, I think the one that I'm using now would get rather tiring after several hundred feet. Ream was in a technical support room adjacent to Mission Control, with a group of spacesuit staff standing by in case anything went wrong. Even though the whole point of the spacesuits was to explore the moon, Ream couldn't wait for it to end. Ream's worries weren't unique to him. Eleanor Foraker, who had supervised the women who sewed the spacesuits, each painstakingly stitched by hand. When the jumping around started, she started thinking about the pressure garment, one of the inner layers of the spacesuit that sealed the astronaut against the vacuum of space. What if all that hopping and tugging caused a leak? Joe Cosmo was one of the spacesuit designers on the NASA side. He was at home, watching with his family, thinking exactly the same thing Ream was. This is great. I hope he doesn't fall over. Ream knew, of course, that the astronauts were just out there euphorically enjoying what they were doing. If the world was excited about the moon landing, imagine being the two guys who got to do it. In fact, according to the flight plan, right after the landing, Armstrong and Aldrin were scheduled for a 5-hour nap. They told Mission Control they wanted to ditch the nap, suit up, and go outside. They hadn't flown all the way to the moon in order to sleep. And there really wasn't anything to worry about. The spacesuits were marvels, 21 layers of nested fabric, strong enough to stop a micrometeorite, but still flexible enough for Aldrin's kangaroo hops and quick cuts. Still, watching Aldrin dash around, Ream could think of nothing but, please go back up that ladder and get back into the safety of that lunar module. When they went back up that ladder and shut the door, it was the happiest moment of my life. It wasn't until quite a while later that I reveled over the accomplishment, said Ream. The Apollo 11 spaceship that carried Michael Collins, Buzz Aldrin, and Neil Armstrong from the Earth to the Moon was big. The Command and Service Module and the Lunar Module, docked nose-to-nose, was 53 feet long. When Collins fired the service module engine to settle into orbit around the moon, the big engine ran for 357 seconds to slow the ship. 6 long minutes. There was already another spaceship in orbit around the moon waiting for them. It had arrived 2 days earlier from the Soviet Union. Luna 15 was a Russian unmanned robotic craft that was at the moon on a mysterious mission. It was certainly no coincidence that at the moment the United States was getting ready to land people on the moon's surface with the whole world watching. The Russians had decided to have a spacecraft at the moon. Luna 15 had been launched on Sunday, July 13, and the Russians said it was simply going to conduct further scientific exploration of the moon and space near the moon. But from the moment of Luna 15's launch, U.S. space scientists and NASA officials speculated that it was a scooping mission designed to land on the moon, extend a robotic arm, scoop up some soil and rocks, and deposit them in a compartment on the spacecraft, which would then zoom back to Earth and maybe, just maybe, arrive back on Russian soil with its cargo before the Apollo 11 astronauts could make it home. Frank Borman, the commander of the Apollo 8 mission that had orbited the moon, had just returned from a 9-day goodwill tour of Russia, the first by a U.S. astronaut to the Soviet Union, and appeared on the NBC News show Meet the Press the morning of Luna 15's launch. "I would guess it's probably an effort to bring back a soil sample," Borman said. "I heard references to that effect in Russia." NASA, at least publicly, was mostly concerned that Russian communications with Luna 15 might interfere with the Apollo 11. In an unprecedented move, Chris Kraft, the head of mission control, asked Borman to call Soviet contacts from his just-finished trip to see if they would supply data on Luna 15. The Soviets promptly sent a telegram, one copy to the White House, one copy to Borman's home near the Manned Spacecraft Center, with details of Luna 15's orbit and assurances that if the spacecraft changed orbits, fresh telegrams would follow. It was the first time in the 12 years of space travel that the world's two space programs had communicated directly with each other about space flights in progress. At a press conference, Kraft said Luna 15 and the Apollo spacecraft would not come anywhere near each other. Luna 15, at least to start, succeeded in making sure the Soviet Union space program wasn't overlooked, while Apollo 11 dominated the news worldwide. The Soviet mission made the front pages of newspapers around the world. At the time, NASA and the public never did find out what Luna 15 was up to. Now we know it was a well-planned effort to upstage Apollo 11, or at least be on stage alongside the U.S. moon landing, according to documents released and research done since the breakup of the Soviet Union, and thanks to the rich and detailed history of the Soviet space program, written by historian Asif Siddiqui, Challenge to Apollo. When Luna 15 arrived in lunar orbit on July 17, 2 days ahead of Apollo 11, Siddiqui says, Russian space officials were surprised by the ruggedness of the lunar terrain where it was headed, and that the craft's altimeter showed wildly varying readings for the projected landing area. As Armstrong and Aldrin stepped out onto the lunar surface, Luna 15 was still swooping around the moon, and engineers back in the Soviet Union were still trying to find a landing site they had confidence in. 2 hours before the Eagle, with Armstrong and Aldrin on board, blasted off the moon, Luna 15 fired its retro rockets and aimed for touchdown. The legendary British radio telescope at Jodrell Bank Observatory, presided over by Sir Bernard Lovell, was listening in real time to the transmissions of both Apollo 11 and Luna 15, and Jodrell Bank was the first to report the fate of Luna 15. Its radio signals ended abruptly. "If we don't get any more signals," said Lovell, "we will assume it crash-landed." Luna 15 was aiming for a site in the Sea of Crises, about 540 miles northeast of Eagle Spot, in the Sea of Tranquility. The Soviet news agency TASS reported that Luna 15 had fired its retro rockets and left orbit and reached the moon's surface in the preset area. Its program of research was completed. Despite taking almost a whole extra day to figure out the terrain issues, Soviet space scientists apparently missed a mountain in the Sea of Crises. On its way to the preset area, Luna 15, traveling 300 miles per hour, slammed into the side of that mountain. At about 1:15 p.m. Eastern Time Tuesday, the Apollo astronauts woke from a 10-hour rest period and were 12 hours into their 60-hour ride back from the moon. As they got started on their day, astronaut Bruce McCandless, Mission Control's official capsule communicator, radioed, "Apollo 11, this is Houston. If you're not busy now, I can read you up the morning news," replied Aldrin. "Okay, we're all listening." A lot of the news was about Apollo 11. Reported McCandless, "Things have been relatively quiet recently in Vietnam. GIs on patrol were observed carrying transistor radios tuned to your flight." About one-third of the way through, McCandless's space newscast slipped in between telling the astronauts that President Nixon would head to Romania after meeting them on board their recovery aircraft carrier, and the Vietnam News. McCandless reported, "Luna 15 is believed to have crashed into the Sea of Crises yesterday after orbiting the moon 52 times. If ever there was a moment that captured the crushing reversal in the performance of the world's two space programs, that was it." Mission Control, matter-of-factly reporting the crash landing of the Soviet Union's somewhat flailing robotic attempt to collect moon rocks to the three American astronauts flying home from the first human landing on the moon with 47.5 pounds of moon rocks. And I hope you've enjoyed that reading of the Apollo 11 Odyssey as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. There's a sidebar titled Apollo at 50. New tributes to the ultimate space epic blast-off this summer at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And there's three of them. First, 50 Years from Tranquility Base. This is an ongoing exhibit. The museum exhibition includes Neil Armstrong's Omega chronograph on view for the first time in 20 years. The 16mm data acquisition movie camera used to record Armstrong's first steps on the moon from the lunar module window is on display for the first time with a film magazine used to capture the moment. And then there's Apollo at the Park running June through fall 2019. The museum will place 15 statues of Neil Armstrong's spacesuit created by 3D scan data in Major League Baseball stadiums across the country. And running July 16 through the 20th of 2019, Apollo 11 Anniversary Celebration. Armstrong's newly conserved spacesuit will go on display for the first time in 13 years. On July 20, the museum will hold festivities day and night. Lectures on Apollo and lunar exploration continue through 2019. Learn more about these and other events at smithsonian.com/Apollo 11. The daredevil inventor behind the world's first deep-diving passenger submarine sets his sights on the most famous shipwreck of all. In this reading, Return to the Titanic by Tony Perrottet. The world looks very different through the eyes of the Cyclops. I learned this one freezing morning this past February after trudging through 2 feet of snow to get to the marina in Everett, Washington, a small port 45 minutes north of Seattle. On the lock was a cylindrical white pod about the size of a moving van, a five-person submersible whose protruding semi-spherical window inspired its name after the monocular monster of myth. A half-dozen men wearing thickly padded khaki jumpsuits and orange helmets gathered on the snow-covered dock, ready to send me under the ice-flecked waves of Puget Sound. The schedule was as rigorously timed as a rocket launch. Vessel prep had been completed at dawn, so after a pre-dive briefing, I climbed a ladder to the top hatch of the sub, took off my boots, and clambered into the tube, which was sheathed in perforated stainless steel. Inside, the pilot, Kenny Haig, was checking instruments, including the modified Sony PlayStation controllers used to steer the sub underwater. There were no seats, but with only three of us on the dive, the other was staff member Joel Perry, I could stretch out like a pasha on a black vinyl mat. With the submersible still resting on its metal launching platform, one end of the platform slowly rose from the dock, and we slid backward into the sea. The milky green waters of Puget Sound rose over the eye of Cyclops One. The support team blurred and vanished, followed by the leaden sky. Even though visibility was only about 15 feet, thanks to storm runoff, a condition my new crewmates dubbed the milkshake, it was still magical to be breathing underwater, an unnatural human state that has captured our imagination since antiquity, when Greek legends of Poseidon and mermen abounded. I was reminded inevitably of Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and Captain Nemo's near-mysterical reverie of the knot on the Nautilus over its mastery of the deep. The sea is everything. It is an immense desert where man is never lonely, for he feels life stirring on all sides. The sea is only the embodiment of a supernatural and wonderful existence. It is nothing but love and emotion. It is the living infinite. This test dunk in the world, in the words of my host from a company called Ocean Gate, was just a taste of what will happen this summer when Ocean Gate will begin taking paying customers to visit the fabled wreckage of the Titanic, which lies some 2.5 miles beneath the North Atlantic. The experimental submersible for those trips, named Titan, closely resembles its sibling, Cyclops One, but Titan is the first deep-sea submersible constructed from a carbon fiber composite, which allows the vessel to withstand enormous pressure at great depths, while being far cheaper to build and operate than more additional subs of equal abilities. Though the average depth of the world's oceans is 2.3 miles, or a little more than 12,000 feet, until Titan came along, only a handful of active submersibles were capable of reaching that depth. And they were all owned by the government of the United States, France, China, and Japan. Then, last December, Ocean Gate made history. Titan became the first privately owned sub with a human aboard to dive that deep and beyond, finally reaching 4,000 meters, or about 13,000 feet, a little deeper than where the Titanic lies. The feat was the culmination of a dream for Stockton Rush, Ocean Gate's maverick CEO and co-founder. "Stockton is a real pioneer," says Scott Perezunski, a 17-year NASA veteran, the first person to have both flown in space 5 times and summited Mount Everest, and a consultant on the Titan expeditions. "It's not easy to take a white sheet of paper, come up with a new submergible design, fund it, test it, and mature it. It was an incredibly audacious thing to do. In his zeal for innovation, Rush stands out even in the elite manned submersible community, which attracts wealthy and eccentric individuals, willing to risk their fortunes on wildly uncertain endeavors. Rush wants to do for deep ocean exploration what Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk are doing for space travel, by taking well-heeled tourists to the deep. At first, each seat cost $105,000, the inflation-adjusted price of a first-class ticket on the Titanic, though the rate has increased to a cool $125,000. Rush hopes to use private enterprise to spur advances in the long-neglected field of underwater exploratory technology and reveal some of the secrets of the great blue unknown. Not that he is given to romantic revelries of the sea. Sometimes Mother Nature works for you, Rush said, smiling wryly as he settled into a chair in a wood-paneled parlor in downtown Seattle. And sometimes Mother Nature is a, well, it rhymes with witch. The vagaries of the weather are an ongoing theme for Rush, with deluges, lightning storms, and other cataclysms wreaking havoc on Titan's test schedules. But he was also referring to the difficulties of our meeting, which occurred while Seattle was being pummeled by its snowiest month in a half century, turning roads into rivers of slush and paralyzing transportation. Just reaching a place for us to sit down had the air of an Arctic trek to the Edwardian age. One reason we chose the historic Hotel Sorrento, which was built for the 1909 Alaska-Yukon-Pacific Exposition, that put Seattle, then a frontier outpost for gold prospectors and fur trappers, on the map. Ever since, the city has attracted independent thinkers, inventors, and misfits with a spirit symbolized by the iconic Space Needle, built for the 1962 World's Fair. As we chatted, snow cascaded down outside the hotel window, cocooning us in an eerie silence and creating the sense that we were sitting in a sub on the ocean floor. With a shock of silver hair and preppy clothes, Rush might be mistaken for a corporate lawyer on casual Friday rather than an ocean adventurer in the mold of a Jacques Cousteau, who was not just a telegenic explorer, but also an inventor of the aqualung in his case. A conversation with Rush jumps between engineering, sacrificial weights, tensile forces, and fairing, the external shell added to streamline a sub, and to business, marketing granularity, and boyish enthusiasm. Rush has a fondness for Star Trek references. His childhood dream, growing up in a wealthy San Francisco family, was to be an astronaut. His parents assumed he'd grow out of it. "I didn't," he says, when Stockton's father introduced him to Pete Conrad, the commander of Apollo 12 and the first manned Skylab mission, and a personal friend. The astronaut advised the teenage math whiz to get his pilot's license. So in 1980, at age 18, Rush became one of the youngest commercial pilots in the world, then signed up to fly chartered planes in and out of Saudi Arabia, all while studying aerospace engineering at Princeton. "It was the coolest college summer job," he says. For his thesis, he designed a high-speed ultralight aircraft. Later, he built his own plane, Glass Air 3. From a kit. You start on page 1 of the manual, and by the time you get to page 680, you have a plane. The astronaut dream was dashed when Rush learned that his eyesight wasn't good enough for him to become a military pilot. In the 1980s, still the astronaut fast track. Instead, he moved to Seattle to work for McDonnell Douglas as a flight test engineer on F-15 fighter jets, then went to business school, Building on inherited money, he invested in a string of esoteric tech companies, wireless remote control devices, sonar systems. Still, he dreamed of going to space, perhaps as a passenger on one of the private rockets being developed in the early 2000s by the likes of Richard Branson. In fact, Rush traveled to the Mojave Desert in 2004 to watch the launch of Spaceship One, the first commercial craft sent into space. When Branson stood on its wing and declared that a new era of space tourism had arrived, Rush says he abruptly lost interest. "I had this epiphany that this was not at all what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go up into space as a tourist. I wanted to be Captain Kirk on the Enterprise. I wanted to explore." As it happened, Rush had been a fanatic scuba diver ever since he was a teenager, and had ventured to the Red Sea, the Cayman Islands, and Tahiti. It dawned on him that Seattle had excellent cold water diving. Puget Sound is full of nutrients, so you have sharks and whales and crabs and dolphins and seals and anemones, he said. "It's an absolutely incredible place to dive, except that it's freezing." He took a cold water dive class, but was put off by the thick, full-body dry suits and vast amounts of paraphernalia, including multiple air tanks. "I loved what I saw, but I thought, there's got to be a better way. And being in a sub, and being nice and cozy and having hot chocolate with you beats the heck out of freezing and going through a 2-hour decompression hanging in deep water." And we're going to have to stop there and hope to continue on next week. Well, that's going to do it for this week. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. And by the way, if you missed the first two readings of the Apollo 11 story, you can go back and reread them or any of our readings for the past several years. It's all there at trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 832-5138.